but to the other woman in his life, to Stella. And the second half of the poem is, in fact, spoken to Stella, in which he quotes Stella's verses to him, which are, in fact, the words cut upon the window pane, if you remember. Stella does not reply. He doesn't take over the medium's voice at all. Then it's over. Everybody says it's a bad seance. It's been spoiled. But everybody except John Corbett, who is a student of Swift and who is absolutely fascinated. Whilst people are going out and leaving their 10 shillings and pound notes for Mrs. Henderson, despite her protest, Corbett says he must speak with her. And he gives the skeptic's version of what has happened, that she is a consummate actress, that she had mimed the whole thing. And so he questions her about Swift, assuming that she must have researched it, otherwise she would never have been able to put on this act as he sees it to be. And Mrs. Henderson doesn't know anything about it. What are you talking about, sir? She's never heard of Jonathan Swift. But this in itself is not important. It is what it enables John Corbett again to say when he is questioning her. He says, Swift was the chief representative of the intellect of his epoch, that arrogant intellect free at last from superstition. He foresaw its collapse. He foresaw democracy. He must have dreaded the future. Did he refuse to beget children because of that dread? And plainly, this is the possibility, perhaps the last possibility that Yeats wants to leave in our head. That the real reason why Swift refused to beget children was that he could see the future, and that the future was to see the levelling down the achievement of everything that the levelling, rancorous, rational mind wanted. And those achievements are the ones that we are normally, that we are often, at any rate, most often, asked to applaud as triumphs of democracy. And then extraordinary coup de théâtre, extraordinary stagecraft at the end, when no one is left except Mrs. Henderson, who is now purely just an ordinary old woman who thinks that she'll make herself a cup of tea and put the kettle on the fire. She moves around talking to herself about this, and then suddenly for the last time, after the seance is over, she is possessed once again without realizing it by the voice of Swift. He says, 5 great ministers that were my friends are gone, 10 great ministers that were my friends are gone. I have not fingers enough to count the great ministers that were my friends and that are gone. And then, after she's gone back to her ordinary voice and potted about and said, where did I put that tea caddy? Ah, there it is. And there should be a cup of sauce. But where's the cup? She moves aimlessly about the stage and then, letting the saucer fall and break, speaks in Swift's voice for the last time, the last line of the play, perish the day on which I was born. End curtain. Okay. Well, now I invite questions and observations.
Yes, sir. Who is Swift's enemy that he talks about?
Yeah. He says, at the end of this turbulent passage of dialogue with Esther, Vanessa, he says, my God, I am left alone with my enemy. Who locked the door? Who locked me in with my enemy? Okay. Who is his enemy? Who or what is his enemy? Yeah.
Isn't it Vanessa and the appeal that she makes to his emotions?
Right. Someone had locked him in with Vanessa. I mean, he is immensely attracted to her. He's only just keeping his desire of her under control as she urges him to satisfy it. And locked me in with my enemy. So his enemy was, in fact, a sensuous, passionate appeal was made to him. I think that's the only possible. You will have noticed, too, that a little earlier in that speech, when Vanessa says, you are not too old for the dice, Dawson, but a few years that you turn away will make you an old, miserable, childless man. Remember that this is not too far from what had been Yeats's own situation. poem we read from Responsibilities, in which he said, I have reached the age of 49. Pardon me, oh fathers, that I have no children. I have nothing but a book. He was well over 50, in fact, before he did marry. Did find a woman younger than himself and did beget his two children. So, even at the autobiographical level, there's something quite closely personal between him and Swift as he envisages Swift here. Sir?
The verse of the hymn that they sing after the passage about being locked in with his enemy, the last line of that is let him no more lie down in sin, which bears, seems to me, on Swift's trying to escape from Vanessa's clutches.
Yes. That's one sort of sin, of course. Another sort of sin is the one by which the angels fell, which is the arrogance of the intellect. Lucifer, in the Christian mythology, Lucifer, the leader of the rebel ages, angels, fell not because of any passionate sexual lust, but because of the lust of the intellect. In the same way, it goes back to the other possibility, the two versions of what happened in the Garden of Eden and the fall. What was the forbidden apple which Eve persuaded Adam to eat? Was it, in fact, the knowledge of carnal voluptuousness, lechery? Or was it not, as the Bible says somewhere, the knowledge of good and evil? So that it does cut your way, it also cuts the other way. And again, part of the sort of comedy and yet the pathos of it is that the verses of this hymn they're talking about these murders, but in what a sort of curiously vague and abstract language they use. When that comes in after Vanessa talking about the white dice of her breast, the contrast is, cannot help but be very startling indeed. No, of course, it is also, for those who get a look, making the point that spiritualism and Christianity are not necessarily exclusive, mutually exclusive. You can be a spiritualist and a Christian at the same time, and the one by being virtue of the other, by virtue of the other, indeed in the revivalist who wants the spirit of the great revivalist Moody to come. In fact, this whole notion, all these notions that he's playing with, are provided for in various forms of Christianity, particularly the notion of purgatory, which is, of course, entirely orthodox, at any rate, in the Roman Church. Yes?
You said the last thing Yeats wants is to
be that Swift named Charlton because he was afraid of the future. No, you misunderstand me. No, I think that's very much what he does want. Yeah, what he very much does want us to. Well, to believe, it is a possibility that he wants us to have very much in mind. And his fear of the future is a fear of the political, of the politics of the future. Yeah?
Why the
Egyptian
control of Lulu in this seance? The reason it comes to my mind is that her childishness, being an actual child, sort of keeps her from the word count down, doesn't distract from what's going on. So she can just sort of point these things out and let the discourse take on.
Yeah, almost like a walking stage direction. Yeah.
Is there any other significance?
Well, I don't think so. I believe, as a matter of record, that seances often do claim that mediums do often claim that their contact is in fact a child in the other world. But also, I think it is all part of the very skillful way in which the comic and bizarre aspects, the possibilities of this situation are allowed for by Yeats. The baby talk that comes through the medium's mouth. And this is surely is what in a very short play gives it this extraordinary depth of shifting planes. At one moment you are near to giggling, at the next you are appalled. suppose you could say that ultimately that it is a tragicomedy. I think this is part of it. Again, an example of how that we have to use these terms with, as with any poet of this sort of this stature, but particularly with Yeats, a profoundly dramatic poet. He is always seeing two sides of any situation. That's that he can see it as at once comical and tragically harrowing. And it's no good saying, well, is he serious or is he poking fun at it? He's doing both. And again, this is an example of one particular way in which the passionate intellect operates. Donne's poems are witty, amusing, at the same time tormented. Swift's own satires, A Modest Proposal, The Tale of the Tub, Gulliver's Travels itself, are at once horrifying and extraordinarily comical. And so I think, you know, this, The Words Upon the Window Pane, as itself an achieved work of art, is in many ways an example of that which it is talking about. How intellect and passion can and should mesh in the most admirable. Perhaps the most admirable lines, too. Stunned, persuaded, dumbfounded, bullied into silence. Well, okay. I mean, I know I've been talking a long time, and I want to set up more of a dialogue. So, you know, if there's anything that anybody wants to say about anything about the course that's gone so far.
I was reading one of his essays, Certain Notable Plays of Japan.
Yeah. I think that's perfectly true. Once again, another way of saying it would be that the comedy involved in it is itself a distance in device. I mean, you're continually reminded that from another point of view, the thing is merely a nonsense, a piece of elaborate comedic self-delusion. That's a good sentence, a very crucial one, and it does go back to what I was talking about when we looked at The Dreaming of the Bones. The way in which the wearing of masks, the lack of a theatre which falls instead merely the unfolding of a cloth, is insisting at every point this is art, not life. There is a relationship between this art and life. Don't mistake one for the other, or else you won't get the benefit, of which is distancing. And this becomes very important to Yeats. Again, it does fit in with what we're talking about, because nothing was more common at the time when these works of modern literature began not to be written. Works like Eliot's Wasteland, like Pound's early poems, like the poems that Yeats was writing from about 1914 onwards. Nothing was more common than for people to react by saying, oh, what sterile intellectualism. And indeed, this is still, I think, the spontaneous response of people when they're first offered these works of modern literature, or indeed these works of modern art in general. Picasso's cubist paintings are quite plainly an intellectualizing of the experience of the visual world. There is no longer any illusion that we are merely recording the variety of the perceived world under the reign of sunlight, for instance. Cubism, classical cubism, is analytical, declares itself to be so. It is a drastic simplification of a landscape or a still life in order to strip it away from its particulars and reveal to us the basic volumes and shapes that are involved. The guitar gets to be no more than a guitar shape. The mountain is abstracted and analyzed into its predominant masses. And all this modern movement in art, and Yeats was very ready to respond to it. He had no difficulty responding to it. He's indeed, from this point of view, extremely intellectual. And by comparison with the art that had gone before, which is still the art that we're mostly used to, because it's still basically the art that gets into a Middlebrow magazine, it certainly gives the impression of a chilling distance between the artist and the person who responds to it. There is no intention to catch you up, you the reader, into what offers itself as a spontaneous, artless, emotional expression. No. The painter, the musician like Stravinsky, or like Schoenberg, the painter like Picasso or Braque or Juan Gris, or Windermuth in England, the sculptor like Brancusi, who is greatly admired both by Yeats and by Pan, all of them are saying, don't forget it, this is a sculpture, first and foremost. No, it is not. You're not supposed to say, oh my goodness, how like a bird that sculpture of a bird is, it can fly away. It's not remotely like that. What's this for bird? it's an interpretation and analysis of the world of shape and form, done by drastic abstracting and stylizing. And this it is easiest to see in the visual arts and sculpture and painting. But you can track the same thing, certainly, in literature and in music. And it's very much Yeats committed to. And again, you see, I mean, it ties out with what he commits himself to in Byzantium. Why Byzantium? Well, if you go into it, the art of the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Christian empire through several generations, centered upon Constantinople, does characteristically express itself in harshly abstract and geometrical forms. It is not naturalistic. And in a poem like Byzantium, therefore, Yeats uses that as indeed a symbol of a sort of passionately intellectual art which he very much admires and would like to emulate. And again, this is not alone. He's not alone in this, I mean. The very beginning of the theorizing which led to modern poetry in English, as you find it in writing to T. Hume, the friend of Pound, poet and philosopher, Englishman who was killed in the trenches of the First World War. You see Hume in lectures and essays dating from about 1908-1909, when he was really formulating what subsequently became the theory of the Imagist movement, which was really the basic overturning movement of 1912 under Pound's generalship. He is specifically saying, We must, a modern art, an art of the 20th century, must no longer be as provincial as we have been. It must no longer suppose that the only precedents that we need to concern ourselves with, the tradition that we are using, comes through Western Europe, from Greece, through Italy and France. That indeed, but we now must realize, the totally different sorts of art, the non-naturalistic, the highly stylized analytical and intellectual art, which we associate with, and he gives a specific example, medieval Constantinople, Byzantium. Or again, of course, Egyptian art, ancient Egyptian art. Or again, Japanese art, the highly stylized and hieratic art of Japan, which by 1908, 1909 was flooding into Europe as a result of the gallant little Japanese having defeated the Russian Navy at Tsushima in 1904. Or again, and this is very interesting indeed, and it's the last point I'll make, ancient Gaelic art. Again, we're now thinking about art in terms of sculpture and painting, sculpture particularly in this case, is again highly abstract and analytical. The decorations in the Book of Kells and the other great illuminated manuscripts from the Irish monasteries, those of them which survive, are incredibly abstract interlacings of geometrical forms, characteristically. And if there is ever a little bird there, that bird has been distorted and abstracted in a way which makes you think more of Picasso than of the 17th century European. All right, then, tomorrow we pick up 1798. Go on, Mr. Morales.
I'd like to start by, however, by saying that I sympathize with the difficulty we're having with exploration. We're getting, in particular, to this essay, the introduction to the work on the window plane. I didn't realize we would be so short. I realized lots of people would be trying to get hold of it and have failed. It was out, it was put on reserve yesterday at noon, right? Someone had it out overnight, which is understandable because it is a long essay, but still, let me repeat the plea. Because we're so short of books, could you please consult at any rate this book, but most of the books really on reserve. Read them there, spare a couple of hours to read them in the evening in the library, so that they knock off the shelves when people go. At the end of yesterday's session, two people came up to me with really very interesting questions about, in fact, this essay, and I think it's right to take them up now. Even though most of you haven't read it, because it would be a preparation. I may say that I am a little irritated at this. We had 20 minutes, 25 minutes yesterday, which I was asking for questions, observations, and some came, but the most interesting ones, and this has happened before, were raised afterwards by people coming up to me after the lecture is over. Of course, I'm always glad to tell you people after the lecture, but I have the questions asked in private rather than in class session is fairly obviously stupid, because it lets me in for giving the same explanation twice over. So may we please, in future, have questions raised in class. And from now on, too, let me make this quite plain, don't wait for me to stop talking and say, now I want questions. Please put up your hands at any point, and I will stop and take the questions. And I hope there'll be a good deal more of that. In fact, I want to get more dialogue going from now on. One thing that should be absolutely certain to us all by now is that Irish history is extremely complicated. And hence I'm sure that there are points which many of you find yourselves unclear or uncertain about. And let them be raised in terms of, look, I didn't quite understand this, will you go over that? Whenever this occurs. Now, these two passages, for instance, are really very interesting. First is a passage where he is talking about Ireland in the first 50 years of the 18th century, after the Protestant ascendancy had been riveted on the island as never before by the Protestant success at the Battle of the Boyne, the defeat of the Catholics at the Battle of Offaly. And here's Yeats talking about that. The Irish landed aristocracy, who knew more of the siege of Derry and the Battle of the Boyne, delineated on vast tapestries for their House of Lords by Dublin Huguenots, than of philosophy, found themselves masters of a country demoralized by generations of war and famine, and shared in its demoralization. In 1730, Swift said from the pulpit that their houses were in ruins and no new building anywhere, that the houses of their rack-ridden tenants were no better than English pigsties, that the bulk of the people trod barefoot and in ranks. He exaggerated, for already the Speaker Connolly had built that great house at Selbridge, where slate, stone, and furniture were Irish, even the silver from Irish mines. The new Parliament House had perhaps been planned, and there was a general stir of life. Now, somebody raised the point that here, where Yeats deliberately contradicts what Swift himself said in 1730, the bulk of the evidence that later historians produce seems to back up Swift. Moreover, that there is, in fact, a failure of logic, as apparently there is. Thus, Swift said from the pulpit that houses in ruins, no new building, was that their tenants in houses no better than the English pigsties, the bulk of the people trod barefoot and in ranks. Yeats says he exaggerated because, and then talks of the very grand and splendid country house built at Selbridge by the Speaker of the Irish House of Commons, Connolly. And this looks like a failure in logic. The fact of one great house by one rich man does not seem in any way to counterbalance the picture of general misery. And this is characteristic of Yeats's operations, and this is the first point that I did make yesterday, which I now repeat. There is an important sense in which Yeats was an uneducated man. He was very widely read, he had a brilliant and perceptive mind. So in most of the senses of educated, he was abundantly educated. But he never went to college. He had no college education at all. Unlike, for instance, in this, most strikingly unlike, the two names that we sometimes associate with him as the great names of modern poetry in English in that generation, let's say T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound. Well, Eliot and Pound were thoroughly trained in scholarly discipline, in the weighing of evidence, the marshalling of it, the framing of a hypothesis, a working hypothesis, the checking of this against the evidence, and so on. Eliot in Harvard, the Sorbonne and Oxford, Pound in University of Pennsylvania, Hamilton College. This Yeats never had. In this sense, therefore, Yeats is an undisciplined thinker. In this way, if we are used to academic history or academic philosophy, or even if it comes to that, academic literary criticism and literary theory, we shall be disconcerted by Yeats's writing in all these areas, in his essays. He does not follow the standard procedures. He does proceed more by leaps of intuition. The intuitions, however, are frequently very penetrating and challenging indeed, and you will find in many cases that the intuitions do comport with the evidence. But Yeats himself doesn't arrive at them in that way, and he doesn't marshal the evidence. He gives you a blank assertion. And that's the first thing to say about this passage.
I was just going to say that that when he says that Connolly has built a big house, he goes on to say that the furniture and the silver is Irish. Now, building a house could be, you know, one, but furniture and silver implies that there were more people than Connolly buying it, that there was some sort of industry making silver and furniture.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is the second point I'm just going on to make. Although there's the appearance of illogic here, in fact, it is quite logical. As Mr. Marx rightly says, the point is, he built that great house at Selfridge where slate, stone, and furniture were Irish, even the silver from Irish mines. In other words, a vast venture like this on the part of the governing aristocracy was, in fact, whether deliberately or by happy accident, obviously stimulating Irish industry and Irish trade. Irish silversmiths were used, Irish quarries were opened to get the slate, stonemasons, furniture, and indeed, this is the point. So that there is more logic to it than there seems to be. Right, well, that's the first passage that was brought to my mind. The second is of a rather different sort and is really going to give us more difficulty, but it's very important. This is where he is talking about tyranny. We have difficulty with this because, well, we could give a whole hour's lecture or more upon, indeed, tyranny and its cognate words, tyrant, tyrannical, and so on. And this lecture probably ought to be given by a historian or a political scientist in the first place, though, in fact, a literary historian would have a great deal to say about it, because some of the difficulties that we have with this group of words, in which we think we know what we mean by these words, but in fact, when we look, we really don't, can best be explicated in terms of the particular history of by which this word has come into our language. And as some of you know better than me, the origin is in fact the Greek word tyrannos, the tyrant. It's translated as the tyrant of Corinth and such and such a town. But in Greek usage, for the most part, I think it is right to say, this is merely descriptive. This carries no note of approbation or the reverse. You're not saying that the tyrant of Corinth was a man who oppressed the Corinthians. Tyrannos in ancient Greek means merely the person who, in whom, during a given period, the entire administrative and executive forces of his particular city-state were concentrated. And in fact, some of the tyrannoi of ancient Greece, in terms of the city-state, are remembered as men of great civilization who greatly enlightened and liberalized. We've lost the sense of that. We now suppose that the tyrant is, we may say, for us it is almost equivalent to dictator. And what's more, it carries the notion of oppression, if not indeed of pathological, sadistic practices against the people whom the tyrant lords it over. Because we have this view, because we think that the tyrant has to be one person, and we think of him like a dictator or an oppressor, we shall be puzzled by what Yeats says in this passage, where he is following Swift very exactly, Swift's own essay on the contests and dissensions between the nobles and the commons in Athens and Rome, 1703. And itself, Swift's looking back to classical precedent, ancient Greek and Roman precedent, in thinking about the problems of the state and the polity. Yeats says of Swift, telling us what goes on in this essay, he defines a tyranny as the predominance of the one, the few, or the many, but thinks that of the many the immediate threat. Now, this is not peculiar to Yeats, it's not peculiar to Swift, it is in fact a highly traditional way of approaching the problems of how to keep a community stable and healthy and to get the right or a reasonable proportion between the two necessary principles of liberty on the one hand, order on the other. But we, here I think I mean products of 19th century parliamentary democracy, though we're not aware of it, have in fact been brainwashed into drastically simplifying this traditional way of analysing the the problems of the state, and interposing that, for instance, the many cannot be tyrannical. For us, the notion of a tyranny of the many is a contradiction in terms. And in fact, we tend to suppose that we have a tyranny. A tyranny is necessarily of one man. There can be only one tyrant at any given time. In fact, though, just to show how the traditional view works out, if we would suppose, these are just examples that come to my mind, you may challenge some of them, but it shows how you can use these terms. For instance, I think we might say that the USSR in the late 1930s was a tyranny of one, a tyrant of one. Tyranny of one, that is to say, of Joseph Stalin. It is fairly plain that, on the contrary, since 1945 and at the present day, in the USSR, if it is a tyranny, as I think it is a tyranny not of one, but of the few. That's to say, the present leader, Brezhnev, is plainly not a single... he plainly has not connected into his hands all the powers of instant life and death which Stalin had. Plainly, Brezhnev is the first among a group, the people at the top of the apparatus who control it. Brezhnev, Kosygin, we know some of their names. The inner circle. There's an example of a tyranny of the one and also a tyranny of the few. A tyranny of the many, well, I've given you an example already. Tyranny is too strong for it, but in the Free Republic, remember, in the Irish Republic, the majority, of course, Roman Catholic, and of course, on touchy matters like divorce and contraception, they voted according to their religious principles. That meant necessarily that the minority, the Protestant minority, who thought quite differently on these issues, they were consistently outvoted, of course, by the strictest parliamentary legal fairness, but they were, to that degree, a victimized minority. And they could rightly say, as Yeats did say for them in the Irish Senate, that they were suffering from a tyranny of the many. And of course the same is true, this always arises as soon as we begin to talk about the rights of minorities. Thus, a lot of us get brainwashed at some early stage in our education, at least I know I did, I don't know if it still goes on, by what has got to be called, for instance, in the context of English history, the Whig interpretation of history, by which you suppose that once you've got universal franchise for men and women above the age of, and here we can fiddle a bit, 21, 18, 16, from the cradle, then politically, all your political problems are solved. And this is taken care of. Order and freedom are there, they're taken care of. Then there are all the economic problems and the rest of it. In fact, as anybody can see, this is not the case. The many can be tyrannical. And indeed, Swift thinks, as the conservative thinker in general does, and as Yeats thinks and goes on to say, the tyranny of the many is the worst tyranny. Because in the long run, it leads to a tyranny or a dictatorship of the one. A tyranny of the many always turns into the tyranny of the one. Because ultimately the majority of people always want to find somebody on whom to shift all the responsibility for that decision making, and they'll always find it. And of course, in many respects, history abundantly bears this out. Insofar as the French Revolution in its Jacobin phase was tyranny of the many, so far as it was, it of course led to a tyranny of the one, Napoleon. The Russian Revolution also leads to the one-man state, Lenin, Stalin, and we see it so often. Hence, Yeats has distrust and fear of mass democracy, of democracy in general. Hence, his being prepared to think well of Mussolini, for instance. In this, I think he was drastically wrong. Mussolini, in fact, is a perfect example of the one man who does come out of the tyranny of the many. Like Hitler, Mussolini... Mussolini was actually a product of, we don't realize it, actually of the left in politics, originally. So I don't think there's no attempt on my part, at any rate, to excuse Gates's foolishness about Mussolini, except to say that it was that his friends were even more foolish about it. But at this point, in the 1930s, T.S. Eliot, D.H. Lawrence, Percy Wyndham Lewis, Ezra Pound were all moving towards the right and into dangerous areas, more dangerous than they conceived of, into admiration of what seemed to be happening in Germany and as well as in Italy. This counterbalancing, an equally panicky and unthinking flight to the left by the other half of the Anglo-American intellectuals, this is to anticipate. But it is true that in the 1930s you see a drastic polarization, and hardly any literary intellectual who will stand in the middle ground. A flight under the pressure, of course, of the Depression and the Great Crash to extreme solutions, either of the right or of the left. And so Yeats certainly doesn't escape this, but it was common to others of his time. We can talk more about that if you want to ask me more when more of you have read the essay. Now, for the rest of this session, our skeletal history of Ireland in the 1960s, whether we can get right through to 1900 or 1912, maybe doubt it, but we'll have a go at it. You remember that this date and these names, with the exception of Father Murphy, these names at any rate, have been up on the board before. That's where we take it up. 1798, or as it figures in Irish folklore and Irish conversation, as simply the 98. What? I put it up again because I didn't sufficiently stress when we talked about it before that this was in fact a very serious insurrection indeed. It was elaborately planned, chiefly by Wolfe Tone, and there was a real chance of it succeeding. It failed because of lack of coordination, which was not so much the Irish, the fault of the Irish, as of Napoleon, indeed, or the French under Napoleon. And also the other reason it failed, and this is a particular example of how Irish history seems never to progress, but merely to repeat itself. The other reason why it failed was that in the months before the rising broke, the English had in fact infiltrated several of the revolutionary cells, particularly those in Ulster, which should have been the strongest, an English undercover agent in fact infiltrated. The English authorities had news of it, and they disarmed drastically before it could ever start the cells that would have risen in Ulster. I say that this is how Irish history never progresses but repeats itself, because it appears very strongly that such successes as the British Army has had against the IRA in the past 6 years have derived almost certainly from the intelligence service and from the infiltration of the IRA itself by British agents, or else by the buying over of IRA men. It's of the nature of these things that the full truth of these matters is never known. That there was, for instance, a mysterious murder, not yet solved, in the south of England only last year, which appears to have been by an IRA assassination squad assassinating a man who had, in fact, betrayed them and informed the British authorities in such a way, in fact, that the British had been able to defuse a large IRA operation northwest of London. So this is the whole history. Again, who betrayed Lord Edward? It's a big question which is still furiously debated in Irish conversation and Irish thought. I believe I misled you about Lord Edward before. He was up here with the wrong date against him. He, in fact, was one of the leaders of the 1798 Rising, and indeed, he was perhaps the best-trained soldier and commander among them, and a great deal of the hopes that it might have been successful depended upon him. He, in fact, escaped the first crushing down of the rebellion. He was on the run, handed from one group of loyal supporters to another for several months, and he was finally betrayed by somebody to the British, mortally wounded in his capture. Again, the same picture. Who betrayed Lord Edward? Remember, the plan was really a very elaborate one. It called for...